welcome to Aerium Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 6th of January 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAlbion.com. Well, it's the first Aerium Britannia of the new year, and we do have my co-host with us today, Mr. Max Musson from Western Spring. Happy New Year to you, sir. How are you doing?
I'm very well indeed, and a Happy New Year to you as well. The year has started off fairly controversially, I think, but there's lots for us to talk about, I think, today, and I'm looking forward to 2020 being a really good year.
Yes, definitely. It has definitely started in controversy, and that was really the first subject that I wanted to bring up, was this assassination of Soleimani over there in Iran. Obviously, this is global news rather than British news, but it does affect us in Britain. And the main thing that I've seen, looking at it from a British perspective, was over the weekend, there were hundreds of Iranians out on the streets of London in mourning for Soleimani. And you may think, well, of course, that's just par for the course, isn't it? We have a lot of Iranians here. Well, maybe not that many, but they are mourning their leader. And then you remember that the Iranians that we have here are all claiming to be refugees from Iran. They're all claiming to have fled here from the brutal regime in Iran, and yet they are all out on the streets mourning for the second in command, which to me just shows, either it shows total hypocrisy, or it shows that, you know, they're just here under a scam, claiming to be refugees, when really they just want to live in the first world and partake of the benefits that white people have. And obviously this assassination, I totally condemn it, and it reminds me of the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, which actually started the First World War. And it does seem as if that's what Trump's intent is to start a war. I mean, what else, you know, what else would you assassinate the second in command of another country for? It has to be the stupidest thing, I think, that Donald Trump has ever done since he's been president, rather. But yeah, what are your thoughts on this, Max?
Well, I think that the main implications for us are that Britain is seen by much of the world as being a very close ally of the United States, and so therefore, when the United States put themselves in the firing line by taking provocative action against a potential enemy, they are, by the same token, placing us in the line of danger as well. And so I think that it's highly likely that there will be some kind of retaliation on the part of the Iranians. What that retaliation will be, I don't know. It's sort of interesting that there have been occasions where the Iranians have been accused of trying to import technology from North Korea. And it's interesting that North Korea have recently tested the latest generation of their intercontinental ballistic missiles, the Tipodong 3, which has got a range of 8,125 miles. And although they may not necessarily have actually exported any of those missiles to Iran, it's quite likely that Iran may have done some kind of deal with North Korea by which they obtain the technology necessary to build their own version of that missile. And so, you know, and if they have, then they've got a delivery system which would then be capable of them delivering retribution to the United States. And I don't really want to sort of focus on the global aspects of this so much as what it means for us here in the UK, which is that obviously if the Iranians do have access to the North Korean missile technology, it means that potentially we in the UK could be in the firing line with regard to missiles fired from Iran. It also means that, putting aside the situation of missiles, if we've got a large number of Iranian nationals who feel very patriotically towards Iran and who feel very supportive and grieved by the assassination of Soleimani, then there is the possibility of some form of homegrown terrorism resulting from these extremist groups within the Iranian community here. And, you know, we don't know what might happen, really do we? The Iranians are threatening that they're going to wreak some kind of grievous retribution, and using missiles. It could be some kind of a nuclear response. It could be just a dirty bomb. It could be ricin. It could be some kind of nerve agent. It could be some kind of biological agents, bubonic plague or Ebola or anthrax or something like that. And so we're in a situation where we are placed in danger of either being on the receiving end of a missile or being on the receiving end of some kind of terrorist action by Iranian extremists here in the UK. And I think it's just a very, very dangerous situation, because the assassination of Soleimani is effectively a declaration of war by the United States on Iran. And the Iranians have responded by raising their red flag of war over Tehran. And so it would appear that although the Iranians haven't said so in so many words, they've pretty much declared by virtue of that flag raising that they feel that they are at a state of war with the United States. And so we need to view developments with a great amount of concern, I think.
Yeah, it was very shocked to see. I mean, I know Donald Trump is foolhardy and hot-headed, but I really didn't think he would go so far as to do something like this. And as you say, we've got a fifth column here. We've already got problems with Sunni Muslims carrying out retribution for our actions in Iraq and in Syria and in Afghanistan, and now we could well have Iranian Shiite Muslims wanting to take retribution against us. I mean, I've always looked at Iran and Persia, and they're actually the Muslims that we've got the most common with, that we have the most in common with. I mean, they allow music, they allow images to be drawn, they have a history of art, they have a very different form of Islam to the Sunnis. And if it wasn't for interference from Israel, I believe, then they would be our natural allies in the Islamic world. But because they have this issue with Israel and Israel's annexing of Palestinian territories, they make Israel and Israel's allies enemies, basically. And Israel does all it can to stir the pot, basically. I noticed that Netanyahu was really pleased about this and saying that America has its right to defend itself. It's not defense, is it? It's not self-defense to go into somebody else's country and drop a bomb on their chauffeur-driven limousine from a drone flying in the sky. I mean, it's absolutely cowardly attack. That's the other thing. It's so dishonorable to do something like that. The man was a great general. He had he managed to remove ISIS from Iraq. He managed to remove ISIS from Syria. He was thought of very highly by the people in Syria and in Iraq. And of course, you know, this is going to badly affect Britain, because we have to go along with whatever America does. America is our ally. On Andrew Marr, they had Dominic Raab, the defense secretary, and he was you know, just making excuses for America, basically. Because it's obviously against all the rules of law, the rules of war, to do something like this. If they were to do that to us, just imagine if the Iranians were to assassinate our Home Secretary in Britain. I mean, that would be an act of terrorism. It wouldn't be a legitimate act of self-defense. And yet that's what's being said here. Do you want to comment some more on that, Max, before we move on to more domestic news?
No, just you're absolutely correct in what you're saying there about it being a great provocation. And I think it's something to be greatly regretted. And there is a need on the part of our politicians and our government to do something to either restrain Donald Trump in the future, or to put some distance between us and what the Americans are doing, and to publicly criticize what they've done on the basis that it is contrary to international law. You know, it's comparable what's been done to, you know, Vladimir Putin and the Russian government were accused of poisoning the Skripals with Novichok here in the UK, and there was a great international hoo-ha about that. But it's quite obviously clear here that the Americans are responsible for this assassination. There's no doubt whatsoever, because the Americans have gleefully admitted they've done it and have been celebrating the fact. And yet it's an identical thing, except that instead of Novichok, they've used a conventional warhead from a drone.
Yeah, that's a very good comparison there, I think. I hadn't actually thought of that myself. Yeah, so you do need to de-escalate tensions and put some distance between us and America. And I did notice that Trump did, he sent out a really stupid tweet with the American flag on it that just made me chuckle at the stupidity of it. But then he sent out another one saying Iran has never won a war, but they always win negotiations. So I think Trump is thinking that by attacking them, it will force them into negotiations, but it's far more likely to enrage them and get them to attack us back. Anyway, that, as I say, that's really sort of world news, and we'll probably cover that more during the week in the Daily Nationalist. We've got, there really isn't that much domestic news to cover. We'll talk a bit more about Alfred the Great later on. But one thing that is going on at the moment, I noticed, was the Labour leader challenge and the Liberal Democrat challenge. And just actually looking at the people that are being put forward for leader of the Labour Party. I mean, I obviously we were hoping for Diane Abbott, and there was the hashtag all in for Abbott. She doesn't seem to have that much support actually within her party. It seems to be just lots of civic nationalists and populists that are all pushing for Diane Abbott to be leader. But the actual list that we do have really isn't that much better. I mean, Emily Thornberry has put her hat into the ring. She's the latest one. And I just find her just so obnoxious. Just this, you can just imagine her stuffing her face with cream pies. And she's just really overweight and obviously through greed. I don't think she has any problem with her hormones or is big boned or anything like that. And she's just a really horrible personality. She was sneering at White Van Man a couple of years back for having English flags, for being patriotic, which she was basically just totally alienating the working class base that the Labour Party basically claimed that they are working for. And yet here she was mocking people who work for a living, builders, labourers, people who drive around in white vans, and mocking patriotism as well, and thinking that the Labour supporters would all support her in this, which they obviously didn't. I mean, this was quite a scandal when she actually did this. And then I can also recall her walking along. Obviously, she supported Remain, and she took part in lots of these protests to try and stop us from leaving the EU. And I can remember her all dressed in blue with these horrible, gaudy gold baubles around her neck that looked like Christmas tree ornaments that were supposed to look like the starry sphincter, the old stars on the European Union flag. I mean, absolutely dreadful woman. What do you make of Emily Thornberry, Max?
I don't make a great deal of her at all, really. In listening to the comments that you've just been making, I think that it's just quite saddening, really, that that there really isn't anybody who you could actually look to and say, oh, yes, they are the natural successor to Jeremy Corbyn, because all these other people are really political midgets by comparison. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn isn't himself a towering figure, but he was somebody who for a while had a certain amount of charisma. And, you know, we had with the Glastonbury 2016, there was, you know, the singing of Oh Jeremy Corbyn and all that sort of thing. So he did have a certain amount of charisma there before the smear campaigns started to take their toll on him. But, you know, looking around at anybody else in the Labour Party, that were all, you know, real political midgets. There's nobody there with any real originality of thought. There's nobody that you could say stands out as being a real character. There's nobody you can say has got any real driving vision for Britain or anything of that sort. And this is, I suppose, really the counterpart of the situation that we had within the Conservative Party, where, you know, with the departure of the sort of aging grandees of the Conservative Party, and with the sort of marginalisation of the aging grandees of the Labour Party, there are just faceless grey people of no real account left, and this is one of the reasons why Boris Johnson won the Conservative leadership election, because he was the only person who had any actual real personality that anybody could appreciate. And, you know, and his personality is that he's a kind of tub-thumping, bombastic kind of guy. But he expounded a vision. He expounded a clear way forward of getting Brexit done at all costs in the shortest possible time. And so, you know, he actually had something to say, whereas nobody else really had anything to say. And that's why, as I say, why Boris won the Conservative leadership election. But when you look at Labour, there's just nothing and nobody of any real account.
Yes, Boris Johnson really does have a lot of character to him and charisma. And, you know, as you say, there just is nobody in the Labour Party. If we have a look at who else they've got there, we've got Rebecca Long Bailey. I've talked about her before. She's the shadow business secretary, and she's really not bright enough to be the shadow business secretary. People may recognise her from this description. She has a huge pair of spectacles, and she has her eyebrows painted on way too high, way up above the actual spectacles themselves. I mean, she looks very, very bizarre. She only looks about 21, 22 years of age. In actual fact, she looks a little bit like she might be Jeremy Corbyn's granddaughter. Certainly has no gravitas to her whatsoever. And she's apparently John McDonnell's favourite. He really wants to see her leading. She's a Corbynista. She's all for Corbyn's agenda of reparations for slavery, open up the borders, anti-hate speech laws, anti-free speech laws, and joining up with the EU again. I mean, really not somebody that I could see anybody particularly taking a liking to and wanting to vote for, or leadership material, in actual fact. I can recall her being interviewed by the BBC and being asked about what Labour wanted to do on the policy with the EU. And she was saying, well, we'll have to ask the EU. We'll have to ask the EU about that. And it just became clear that, you know, that's who she was answerable to, was the European Union, not even to her own party. And you know Rebecca Long Bailey, Max? What do you make of her?
Well, I know of her. I reckon that you make of her. She has called Jeremy Corbyn around, you know, been at his side on a number of occasions. And so, you know, as you say, she certainly looks like his protege in that respect. She's also supported by the same unions that supported Jeremy Corbyn. Again, she can be seen as somebody who has inherited Jeremy Corbyn's mantle as far as the unions are concerned. But again, she is somebody who has made no real impact as far as the British public are concerned. And if you look at the people that you've mentioned, they are the sort of people that if they were to appear on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, most members of the public would say, who the hell are they? Because most people wouldn't know who they are. And they wouldn't in their own right be regarded as any kind of celebrity at all from any real perspective. And so therefore that they are people that nobody really can get particularly excited about. I think as far as Keir Starmer is concerned, he is the person who is least associated with the with Jeremy Corbyn, and so he was a Remainer. But I think that in that he's the person least associated with Jeremy Corbyn, it appears that he is certainly the favourite as far as people who were the main critics of Jeremy Corbyn, which obviously was his organised jury in this country, who, you know, conducted this 4-year-long campaign, smear campaign against Corbyn. And Keir Starmer stands apart from him in many respects, and so therefore would appear to be their favourite. And there have been a number of statements made by or made in the Jewish press that Keir Starmer would be their preferred candidate. But really, apart from that, it's just a morass of greyness when you look at the Labour Party, really.
Well, he's the token male, actually, in the list. He's also actually responsible for changes to the CPS guidelines to actually make minority victims always believed. So regardless of the evidence, the Crown Prosecution Service or the police should believe a minority when they claim to be a victim. He was responsible for those changes that are actually being looked at now in a judicial review. But he's the token male, and I'm not sure they're going to vote for him. Because they're talking about, well, we must have a female leader this time. So it's, you know, it's what gender you are is more important than what you're actually capable of. The next one I've got on the list here, Angela Rayner. She's the Shadow Education Secretary. And I think she must have been to the same school that Sadiq Khan went to, because she's unable to formulate coherent sentences either. I've seen her interviewed, and she's awful, awful woman. Really doesn't have a clue what she's doing. Another one, Jess Phillips, this horrible harridan feminist who laughs at the high suicide rate among men. And she had a big public spat with Sargon when he was standing for UKIP. She's the MP that he said that he wouldn't even rape. And she was crying all these crocodile tears on the television about claiming that Sargon had made this credible rape threat against her. And it was a bit of a bad taste joke, but he was saying no, he wouldn't rape her. Silly hill for Sargon to die on. But this woman is absolutely dreadful, and she did laugh at the high suicide rate. She argues that she didn't, and she was talking about something else. But when it was brought up, she laughed and said, you know, that's not important. What is important is feminism. And the final female on the list is Yvette Cooper, another really, really loathsome female Labour MP. She's been there since Tony Blair, I think, married to Ed Balls. And this is the MP that was on the Commons Select Committee talking about YouTube, where they brought in this head from YouTube, and a good rollicking, basically, and it became very clear that she was completely unaware how YouTube actually works. She'd obviously been looking at alternative media sites and was then shocked to discover that YouTube had other alternative media sites to look at in the advertising bit in YouTube. And she thought that YouTube were deliberately sending her these alternative media sites. And she seemed to particularly have it in for Red Ice. I mean, she mentioned them by name, and I think she was calling them vile people or vile white nationalism. And, it just reminds me of Amber Rudd, another one who doesn't seem to understand how the internet works or how encryption works, and thinks that you can just build a back door into everything so that the government can have a look at what people are saying, as if the government should be able to listen in on what people are saying in their private conversations. So absolutely none of them are actually even up to the standard of Jeremy Corbyn, I don't think. What do you make of these other three, Max? Angela Rayner, Jess Phillips, or Yvette Cooper?
Well, Angela Rayner has linked herself with Rebecca Long-Bailey, and there's been this suggestion that they've both formed a pact in which Rebecca Long-Bailey will aim to become the Labour Party leader, whilst Angela Rayner will be the deputy leader. Haven't seen the two of those women, though, on occasions on TV. I would probably say that Angela Rayner is probably the one with the most charisma out of the two. I've not really listened to any great extent to whether or not she's able to formulate coherent sentences, but she seems to be a little bit more charismatic than Rebecca Long-Bailey. So perhaps it ought to be the other way round, that Angela Rayner is the one that goes for the leadership and Rebecca Long-Bailey should go as her deputy. But, Jess Phillips, to be honest, I struggle to actually picture in my mind what Jess Phillips looks like. Yvette Cooper, she's got a lifelong habit of saying ridiculous things, in my view, and I think she's probably the least credible one of those women candidates, to be quite honest. And she again is, she's not a particularly old person, but she is more associated with prior Labour administrations, and so she is kind of tainted with the same brush that the old Labour grandees such as Peter Mandelson, etc., are. She is of that ilk, and I think that as far as the Labour Party members are concerned, they're probably going to be looking for somebody who's going to be new and dynamic, somebody who could stand up in the House of Commons and at Prime Minister's question times, do battle with Boris Johnson with some hope of actually scoring points. And certainly I don't think Yvette Cooper would be there. And I don't think, well, I think my guess out of the others is that probably, I would say, yeah, Angela Rayner probably would come as probably the best candidate out of that lot, only by a short margin, and only because she just appears to be a little bit more confident and charismatic in front of the camera. Rebecca Long Bailey seems to be, she looks like a shy kind of person who moves to the corners and sits at the back rather than being the sort of person who'd like to be out front. She just hasn't been out front enough, I don't think, and just doesn't appear to conduct herself with any kind of confidence or authority. But yeah, I mean, you know, as I said before, none of them is a particularly exciting candidate, and I can imagine that the vast majority of Labour members now are in something of a quandary as to quite what they're going to do, because they seem to be now committed to getting rid of Jeremy Corbyn, but there isn't really anybody of any substance to replace him, and they might be inclined to turn around and ask Jeremy Corbyn to come back.
Now that would be good. I mean, there are a few other women on the list. There's one, Lisa Nandy or something like that. The BBC seem to think that she stands a good chance. Jess Phillips is pretty plain looking. She's from Birmingham. She's a Birmingham MP. And as you say, Rebecca Long Bailey, she's definitely not leadership material, more of a wallflower, as you say, somebody that hangs in at the corners at parties and doesn't really want to come forward into the spotlight at all. So we'll just have to wait and see who eventually wins the Labour leadership challenge. We've also got the Liberal Democrat challenge, and the main one that's putting herself forward here, I'd seen her before in the Houses of Parliament and just thought, what an awful cat lady. You know, total feminist, again, with huge cat lady glasses and a school mistress voice, and she's got her hair dyed black. Her name is Leila Moran, and I think she stands a good chance of winning this because she's come out as a pansexual over the weekend. She's actually a lesbian, but it's more fashionable for her to call herself a pansexual. I've got a quote here from the article. It says, earlier this year, she admitted that she and her then-boyfriend, Richard Davis, had been detained by police after a row at a party conference turned violent in 2012. She admitted slapping the financial analyst because she felt threatened. She describes her actions as defensive. Charges against both were dropped and the relationship ended. I mean, can you imagine if a bloke slapped a woman because he felt threatened? And then described his actions as defensive. Can you imagine that the police would be dropping those charges? I mean, she claims that she believes in equality and she believes in feminism and all the rest, but she clearly thinks that women are allowed to do things like this and they should just be allowed to get off. And obviously she left this boyfriend for a girlfriend now, and she's hoping that because she's a pansexual lesbian, that ticks all the boxes for being leader of the Liberal Democrats, I think. Have you come across Leila Moran before, Max?
Well, I've only seen articles recently where she's been saying the sort of things that you have you've been mentioning. She, again, is another person who she's cut out of the same kind of cloth as Joe Swinson, from what I can see. As you were talking there, we were laughing about the greyness of all the Labour Party candidates. Well, I think that the Liberal Democrats are infected with exactly the same problem, in that Joe Swinson was a grey character that had got no real no real oomph, no real charisma or anything of that sort. And this other lady would appear to be, as I say, cut out of the same cloth. And in fact, as you were talking there about Leila Moran, I was struggling to actually remember Joe Swinson's name, and only just remembered it in the sort of nick of time. And so that really reflects the lack of impact that these people make, and they come forward and have their little 15 minutes of fame, but don't tend to have any real impact on our country, don't tend to have any character, as I say, any charisma. If you were to stand 100 people from off the street up against the wall and demand that they tell you one of Joe Swinson's opinions, I think perhaps they might be able to say that she is a Remainer as far as the European Union is concerned. But more than that, I doubt that anybody could actually think of anything that she's ever said. And I would think the same goes for this Leila Moran as well. They are just faceless, grey people of no real account, in my view.
Totally inconsequential. I mean, the Conservative Party does have all the characters, doesn't it? Jacob Rees-Mogg, Boris Johnson, can't recall the names of others, but that's just a momentary lapse of my memory there, because Peter something or other Bone, he's another good one. John Redwood. Oh,
just having two real characters puts that's head enough. And shoulders above everybody else.
That's enough. That's what we need. We need characters in politics. You know, we need quick thinking people that have a vision for the country, have ideals, and that's what they're working to achieve. Not people that are sort of looking at it as in, oh, we're just running a business and we just do what we're told to do by the EU, which is basically Labour and the Liberal Democrats. And of course, we'll keep an eye on this as the weeks go on, up until they have their leadership elections. But as promised, we're going to continue with our Greatest Britain series with Alfred the Great. We've had two episodes, I believe, looking at Alfred the Great so far. This is the third one. And we're going to begin by talking about the law courts today that Alfred instigated. Alfred insisted that his judges be literate so that they could apply themselves to the pursuit of wisdom. The failure to comply with this royal order was to be punished by loss of office. And this is important because you think of judges today, well, of course they know how to read. But back then they had judges that weren't actually literate. And part of this was to do with the Viking attacks, which had destroyed a lot of the infrastructure and prevented people being able to educate themselves, but also because they just didn't have anybody there that could actually read. And one of the laws that he had was if they weren't able to read and they weren't able to get somebody else that could actually read for them and read out aloud for them, then they would lose their office. And legend has it that Alfred actually hanged 100 judges for corruption. I mean, he was really hot on justice. He would also sit in the court himself to ensure that the peasants were treated with equal justice to the lords and the nobles. And remember, in the last episode, we talked about the Vergild. So they did have a hierarchy, and they had people that some people were worth more than others. But they were still accorded equal justice. They may have got, if you were a peasant, you may have got less compensation for something, but they would still have had equal justice, and they would have had their case heard just as if they were a lord or a noble. And to think that, you know, the king was taking an interest in sitting there in court to make sure that this actually happened. And the people's quality of life was massively improved, basically, after this peace with the Vikings had come about and a new golden age of learning began. Max, you got any comments on the institution of Alfred the Great's law courts?
Not any specific observations to make at this point. I think as far as his reform of the law courts, this really is just another facet of Alfred's greatness, really, that he not only defended England and Wessex, as it was then, against the attacks of the Vikings. Not only did he build a navy, not only did he do lots of other great things, but in addition to all of that, he also brought about this reform of the law courts. I think it's a shame, really, that there isn't more education within our education system focusing on the things that Alfred did, because the more you learn about Alfred, the more you are impressed with the scope of his vision for what he wanted to create. And it's just one of these really impressive things that often gets overlooked, but you know, once you focus on it, once you appreciate all that he did in terms of establishing England as a country, you know, you can't help but be impressed. You can't help but be inspired to try to mimic and to try to replicate the sort of things that he did, and that's really my main observation.
He took it very seriously, being a king. He was the people's king, and his role was to improve the lives for the people and to make sure that the facilities were there for them to improve their own lives, make sure that the facilities were there for them to learn how to read. And as we said in the last episode, he codified all the laws so that was all written down. So there were written laws that these judges could refer to, and our common law began there, and our system of precedent. And when there were changes to the law, would be made actually in the courts themselves, and precedent would necessitate that a law would change. And it wasn't just the justice that he changed. There was a total revival of the liberal arts, and this revival entailed the recruitment of clerical scholars from Mercia, Wales and abroad on the continent to enhance the tenor of the court and of the episcopacy, the church. The establishment of a court school to educate his own children, the sons of his nobles, and intellectually promising boys of lesser birth. An attempt to require literacy in those who held offices of authority. A series of translations into the vernacular English of Latin works that the king deemed most necessary for all men to know. The compilation of a chronicle detailing the rise of Alfred's kingdom and his house, with a genealogy that stretched back to Adam, thus giving the West Saxon kings a biblical ancestry. And it also has Wotan in there. I mean, there's so much interesting stuff here in this revival of the liberal arts, particularly with the schools that he instituted. And this was for the first time looking at people, not just, oh, because they've got lots of money, their children should learn how to read and write, but boys of lesser birth that showed that they had the aptitude, that showed that they were bright and they were keen to learn, they were given scholarships, basically, in this school. And Alfred himself would teach. In some instances, he would be the guy that was doing the teaching, and he got all these books translated so that people could learn. So he's obviously looking at the next generation that are going to come up after him, and wanting to educate these children as much as he could, and ensure that that next generation had a hierarchy already there. It already had people that were well educated that could be leaders in society. And, you know, we still do this today. We still have scholarships. We have schooling that is available to everyone. And hopefully the brightest children get the best schooling. They get to go to grammar schools. They still have scholarships today. And this compilation of a chronicle, we already had the Anglo-Saxon chronicle, but he had this life of Alfred the Great that was a Bishop Asser that we were talking about last time. What do you make of his revival of the liberal arts, Max?
Well, I think that in terms of the development of modern nation states, if we look at the size of a human organization that can be created around a family or a clan, then a lot of social scientists will point to the fact that it's very difficult to actually organize more than perhaps 150 people as a kind of a clan. And within, if you can then find a means of binding and uniting several clans together, then you can create a little principality. And when you look back at Europe and you look back at Europe during medieval times, what you see is that most of the modern day nation states were actually made up of dozens, sometimes hundreds of small principalities and kingdoms, each of which was very weak and each of which was very vulnerable to attack by its neighbors, etc. And because of the fact that they were weak and they were vulnerable to attack, they had to spend a disproportionate amount of their time on defending themselves and on the military, which then meant that the nations themselves were actually quite poor. And then what's happened as we've come out of the medieval times and through the Middle Ages is that in each nation, generally speaking, there has been a great national figure that stepped forward and that has brought about a massive unification of all of these tribal groups and of all of the principalities and the kingdoms that previously existed. And so if we look at Italy, there's Garibaldi in the 1800s who united all the little principalities that were formerly made up Italy. If we look at Germany, then there's Bismarck, who brought about the unification of Germany. And I think that just as we here in England were ahead of our time in terms of the agricultural revolution and the industrial revolution, so in terms of having a unifying king or monarch, we were ahead of our time again in King Alfred. And what Alfred did there was that the way that you bind large numbers of people together is that you devise a unifying myth or a unifying story that all of those people can identify with, so that even though they may be some distance from the actual monarch themselves, even though they may be some distance from other groups and tribes and principalities that have now been united into one, because of the fact that they have this common idea, this common national story, this common national myth, that enables them to identify with each other and it enables them to make common cause with other people who are of a similar belief system to themselves. And I think that's what's happened here with Alfred. He had the foresight to realize that what he needed to do was to create this, first of all, a common legal system, but more than just a common legal system, a common system of worship and a common national story that was built around the chronicle of his life, effectively, and that's why he was then able to unite under his leadership such a large part of the British Isles, which then made England the dominant of the kingdoms within the British Isles, which then led on to the unification of the British Isles, etc., and us becoming a first-ranking nation within the world. And so I think that we owe a lot of our history and we owe a lot of our subsequent success as a nation to the foundations that were set by Alfred during his reign.
That's probably an important part of that genealogy. Because he's putting in there that as well as Christian figures like Adam and Noah and Shem, he's also got Wotan in there. He's also got the Goths in there, Geat, who it says was a god to the Goths. So he's basically putting in Christianity, and he's also putting in the history of the Saxons in there, and tying it all in together in this genealogy, and saying, this is why we're following this religion, and this is who we are. And on top of that, his greatest regret was that he wasn't actually taught the liberal arts when he was a child. And he went to Rome, and he also had a lot to do with the Franks and the Frank kingdom, and he saw that that's what they had there, and he just wished that he'd been taught that when he was a child. So in a way, what he was doing was thinking, well, what did I wish that I had when I was a child? Well, I wished that I was taught the liberal arts. Well, in that case, what I need to do is provide tutelage in the liberal arts for the children of my people. So totally selfless action doing that. And his education came, a lot of the time, it came from court people that were at the court reading out books aloud to him while he was doing all his other work. So it was like having Radio 4 playing all the time, or having Radio Albion playing all the time while he was working. And that was how he educated himself. And today we can just switch the radio on and we can hear, you know, we can hear audio books, or we can hear podcasts talking about different subjects. Back then that wasn't possible, but he hit on the idea of having the people at the court doing that to him, which I always found interesting, thinking, you know, we're all just like the king now. We can just switch the radio on when you think of that. His education and translations comes next. And Alfred himself translated some works from Latin into English. And remember that he wasn't actually able to write. And this apparently happened through a miracle. This is one of the miracles that the Orthodox Church refer to, that Alfred learned how to translate from Latin into English by a miracle. And apparently he translated lots of books into the vernacular of English, although some of them they doubt now. In particular, he wanted the Bible translated into English, and he started work on that himself. And remember, this is the 9th century. This is about 870. And we didn't have the King James Bible until, I think, about the 16th century. So almost 1,000 years before then, we have Alfred the Great translating the Bible from the Latin Vulgate into English and putting a Bible in every one of the churches. So, and then teaching everybody, or teaching certain members in society, how to read so that they could read the Bible for themselves. And he was the guy that actually did the translations. We still have some of his Psalter, which is, I think that's all we've got left now, is the Psalms that he translated. And he gives introductions himself to each of these Psalms. And I thought they were particularly interesting because they mention the Jews. This is one of them. The text of the following Psalm is called Psalmus David, Psalm 2. It is so called because David in this Psalm lamented and complained to the Lord about his enemies, both native and foreign, and about all his troubles, and everyone who sings this song does likewise with respect to his own enemies. So too did Christ with respect to the Jews. So he's saying there, Christ's enemy was the Jews, and it's also showing there that he had a lot of respect for David, who wrote the Psalms. David was a bit of a hero to him, and there are a lot of warrior psalms, basically, all about fighting your enemies and having victory over your enemies and calling to God for victory over your enemies. So that was very important to him. And the second quote that I've got here says, "And he also prophesied that the men who are the two tribes, namely Judah and Benjamin, should do likewise, that they should thank God that he protected them from the siege and from the two kings. And he prophesied the same with respect to all righteous men who are first oppressed and then spared. And he prophesied the same with respect to Christ and the Jews." And I thought that was interesting because he draws a distinction there between Judah and Benjamin, the two tribes of the Israelites, and the Jews. He doesn't say Judah and Benjamin are the Jews. He's making a distinction there between the Israelites of the Old Testament and the Jews that are mentioned in the New Testament, which is not something I was really expecting. I mean, it's something that we talk about a lot in Christian identity, but here you have Alfred the Great basically saying that the Jews were a different people to Judah and Benjamin from the Old Testament. And there's a third reference to the Jews, which is actually in the life of Alfred the Great. And it says, "They, the monks, were secretly embittered to such a degree that in the manner of the Jews, they ambushed and betrayed their Lord by treachery." And at this time, there were no Jews in Britain. There weren't any Jews in Britain until 1066, when William the Conqueror came over and he brought them with him. But Alfred the Great was well aware of them and knew that they were treacherous, and he didn't want them in his country. I believe at this time, they depicted the Jews with horns and a tail, and they didn't even know what they looked like. And so this gives us an idea that this idea of being against the Jews is not anything new. And our greatest king saw that to be a Christian you needed to be against the Jews and to be careful of them, be aware of them, basically. So those are the main translations that he did. He also did St. Gregory's Pastoral Care. He thought that was a particularly important book that people should read. I've got some more here about education and writing, but do you want to make a comment about these Bible translations and Alfred's translations from Latin into English, Max?
I've got no sort of considered comments that I'd like to make, really. I find them interesting. I'm not a sort of committed Christian myself, so as far as quotations from the Bible are concerned, I don't place a great deal of store by them, to be quite honest. And I think it could be argued that if there were no, you know, if at that time there were no Jews in England, then they were, you know, any statements that were made based upon word of mouth that would have been passed on by third parties, etc., that had perhaps travelled abroad and wouldn't necessarily have been based in any experiences that they themselves had encountered. And so I suppose I'm loath to label all Jews with the reputation that preceded them as far as England was at that time. I think that the kind of remarks that are made there are made from a religious perspective, when in reality what they should be made from is from a social dynamics perspective. And and I've always maintained that the main reason why we as British nationalists should be opposed to immigration is not that any particular immigrant group is particularly evil or anything of that sort, but just that the existence of a multicultural society encourages immigrant groups to behave in ways which are contrary to the interests of the host population. And really that's the direction that I would approach this kind of thing from.
Well, again, with multiculturalism, I mean, the reason why Alfred was able to make this peace with the Vikings, it wasn't just because they became Christian, but because they were the same race as the Anglo-Saxons. So,
yes, absolutely,
you know, they blended in. As for what Alfred has to say there about the Jews, that can only have come from church teaching and from the Bible itself. Because, as you say, he didn't have any experience of the Jews himself. That comes specifically from the Bible. Getting on to education and writing, the Danish raids had a devastating effect on learning in England. Alfred lamented in the preface to his translation of Gregory's Pastoral Care that learning had declined so thoroughly in England that there were very few men on this side of the Humber who could understand their divine services in English or even translate a single letter from Latin into English. And I suppose that there were not many beyond the Humber either. Manuscript production in England dropped off precipitously around the 860s when the Viking invasions began in earnest, as numerous Anglo-Saxon manuscripts were put to the torch, along with the churches that housed them. A solemn diploma from Christ Church, Canterbury, dated 873, is so poorly constructed and written that historian Nicholas Brooks posited a scribe who was either so blind he could not read what he wrote, or who knew little or no Latin. It is clear, Brooks concludes, that the Metropolitan Church of Canterbury must have been quite unable to provide any effective training in the scriptures or in Christian worship. So that shows us just what a state the country was in. I mean, Alfred is not joking when he's saying that there's nobody here who can read or write. It has got that bad, and there was no manuscripts. And again, this also makes it clear the opposite case was occurring in Wales, because that's where he got Archbishop Asher from, who was the guy that wrote the book of Alfred's life, and he brought over churchmen with him to teach, and obviously they brought over people from France as well. So, you know, that is quite a change to go from having nobody able to read and write to having these schools, having a new golden age, having all the liberal arts taught. And it also shows us that, you know, people like to idolize the Vikings, but I mean, they were pretty much you know, just behaving like vandals here, just destroying what there was left of civilization in Anglo-Saxon England, setting fire to the churches, setting fire to the manuscripts, chasing the monks out from where they were, and just putting the country back, you know, hundreds of years, basically, trying to put the country back to the Stone Age. It had got that bad. It was quite an amazing turnaround that Alfred did to get everybody learning once again. Do you want to make a comment on that, Max?
Oh, yeah. I think as far as the learning is concerned, the literacy and learning very much depended upon the monks and the church at the time, because they were the only people really that had the facility to store books. And, you know, the Christian church was built around the Bible, and so therefore monks and priests needed to be able to read the Bible, and so therefore, because they needed to be able to read, they had to teach each other to read, which then meant that they were the obvious people to operate schools. And I think one of the ill effects that came about as a result of the Viking invasions was the fact that the Vikings identified that the churches contained lots of loot and lots of gold and that kind of thing. And so therefore they targeted them, and in looting the churches and slaughtering the priests, etc., they slaughtered the people who were the few people in those days who were literate and able to teach reading to other people. They probably slaughtered quite a few of the young students that were studying with the monks, and they would have burnt and destroyed lots of the books and the manuscripts that the monks would have used to learn to read and to record things and to teach others to read. And so therefore the advent of the Vikings from the point of view of the academic well-being of this country was very, very destructive, and so therefore it needed something to redress that. And Alfred was as he was in so many other areas, he had the foresight to realize what needed to be done in order to rectify the situation, and he sought out the people who were capable of providing the education that was needed, and appealed to the parts of the British Isles where that had been least affected by the Viking invasions, in order to find the literate people and the clerics necessary in order to pursue or to implement his policy.
Yeah, I think you're probably right there. Those churches would have been very ornate. There would have been a lot of gold there, and it would have been the loot that the Vikings were after, rather than just destroying all the knowledge that was there. Well, Alfred's educational ambitions seem to have extended beyond the establishment of a court school, believing that without Christian wisdom there can be neither prosperity nor success in war. Alfred aimed to set to learning, as long as they are not useful for some other employment, all the freeborn young men now in England who have the means to apply themselves to it. Conscious of the decay of Latin literacy in his realm, Alfred proposed that primary education be taught in English, with those wishing to advance to holy orders to continue their studies in Latin. There were few books of wisdom written in English, and Alfred sought to remedy this situation through an ambitious court-centered program of translating into English the books he deemed most necessary for all men to know. It is unknown when Alfred launched this program, but it may have been during the 880s when Wessex was enjoying a respite from Viking attacks. Alfred was, until recently, often considered to have been the author himself of many of the translations, but this is now considered doubtful. Scholars today often refer to translations as Alfredian, indicating that they probably had something to do with his patronage, but are unlikely to be his own work. So that's all the freeborn young men in England who showed they had the aptitude were given free schooling. I mean, this is this is incredible that this was going on back then in
amazing,
in 870. And again, as you say, Max, you know, it was these monks that were responsible for this. as well. But part of it, as it says here, is because, you know, he thought that without Christian wisdom, there can be neither prosperity nor success in war. There was none of this turn the other cheek. They needed to have success in war. They needed to defend themselves. And then once you have your victory, you know, the Christian teaching is that you shouldn't enslave these people, which is what he did with the Viking Guthrum, and he baptized him. And then they had the peace between the Vikings and the Saxons. He was a very God-fearing man, and he believed that it was because they had sort of lost their faith and they didn't have any Christian scriptures that they were losing against the Vikings in the war, because they didn't tend to see it like that.
I think by spreading literacy amongst the common people and by translating books into English, which is the language of common people, that again facilitated the understanding and the spreading of the chronicle about his life, which could then become the kind of formative document that would bind the smaller kingdoms that predated England together as part of his drive to creating an England. You see what I mean?
Yeah, it's interesting that he was translating them from Latin into English, and then, you know, fast forward 600, 700, 800 years, and you've got the church trying to keep the Bible entirely in Latin and actually banning the Bible being written in the vernacular. And they were saying, well, it's got to be kept in Latin. That was the original language that it was written in. It's a heresy to have the Bible written in English. And yet you've got Alfred the Great hundreds and hundreds of years earlier, and he's translating the Bible into English, and he's teaching everybody in English as well. And before then, you know, the writing was just in Latin. And Latin at the time was the equivalent of English today. It was the language of commerce. You know, you can use English in whatever country you were in, because it's the language that's used for business. And back then it was Latin, and before then it was Greek. So even though we had our own language in Britain, I mean, even before the Saxons, we obviously had our own Brittonic language, and a lot of that is still there in the Welsh today. The actual writing down of documents would have all been done in Latin. So that was this big change here as well. And as I say, it was supposed to have been a miracle that actually gave Alfred the ability to translate from Latin into English. Well, I think
it can also be argued that Alfred is the person who made English the language that it is and made it the international language. Because if Alfred hadn't done that, if we had continued to conduct all of our business and our trade in Latin, then Latin would have become the world language rather than English, and our position in the world would have been so much more diminished by that.
Yeah, I don't know if they had Frankish or German at this time. You know, I don't think they did. I don't think they did. So, I mean, probably one of the first countries to actually come out with a language that was separate to Latin, actually, in Europe. I mean, we had the runes before then, but obviously Alfred had the runes. I mean, he was a Saxon, but I don't think there was much that was actually written using them. I don't think there's enough of them to get words across. It's not like spelling is, which we have with the English language. I mean, some of it you can understand. I've looked at the Brut or the Chronicle of England, and that's written in Old English. There's a lot of words like muckle in there. It's very Saxon, obviously, because it was before the Normans came over, and the Normans changed a lot of our language. If you want to know what the Saxon dialect sounds like, then go to Dorset and Devon.
I think there would have been Frankish and Germanic dialects at the same time in the 9th century, just as there was Old English in England. It's just that Alfred had the presence of mind to translate lots of writings and lots of text into English, which then meant that English became the primary language of commerce as far as England was concerned, and then as far as the British Isles were concerned. But then with the formation then of many years later of the British Empire, it then meant that English became spread all over the world, which then resulted in English being the language of commerce today, and gave it its position of primacy in terms of languages.
Yeah, I'm not saying that they didn't have a vernacular. I'm just wondering whether they actually wrote it down, whether they wrote stuff down in German wrote it down in Francian at this time at 870. Because I'm not sure that we have German manuscripts from that time that aren't written in Latin basically or in runes. That's what I'm unsure about. Maybe we can find out about that before the next episode. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Max. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Aryan Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.